Welcome to Best Bets, the Sandringham Research School podcast. This podcast aims to provide you with the latest education research and insights about how evidence can be used to benefit students in your school. Although education research can never tell us exactly what to do within the classroom, it can provide us with best bets, tried and tested approaches that the evidence suggests may lead to promising outcomes. In each episode, we'll draw upon the experience of a researcher or teacher with a particular expertise in the area we're looking at. And a little bit about us. Sandringham is a Hertfordshire secondary school and has been designated as a research school by the Education Endowment Foundation. You can follow us on Twitter at SandResearch. Welcome to episode 2 of Best Bets, which features science teaching expert Dr. Nikki Kaiser. Nikki is a chemistry teacher and research lead at Notre Dame High School, the research school in Norwich, and has been teaching for over 10 years. Prior to this, she worked as a postdoctoral researcher in marine biogeochemistry, crossing the equator multiple times as she investigated ocean-atmospheric interactions. Nikki is currently seconded to the Education Endowment Foundation as their science content specialist. Nikki is also the recipient of the School's Education Award from the Royal Society of Chemistry for the incorporation and dissemination of research-informed teaching approaches. Nikki is a firm believer that research should always begin with the why, but she understands that the what and how are also important, and she is keen to find accessible ways of putting research into practice. Welcome to this episode, Nikki, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, thank you for asking me. It's really nice.
Great. Well, it's good to have you in today's podcast, which we'll be looking at really taking a focus on science teaching. So although I've just introduced you, it'll be really great to hear from you in your own words about what drives you as a science teacher and one who has done so much to advocate being informed by research evidence.
Oh, what drives me? I think, without sounding really, I'm an unexpected science teacher. I never expected to study science, let alone teach it. And I think because I almost discovered the joy and the wonder of science as I grew up. I feel like I want to allow other people to find that as well. My dad was a linguist and we did a lot of music and kind of language within our family, and I certainly also always expected that I'd be a musician or something, and so the science kind of just grabbed me later on unexpectedly, and I really feel for the it's wonderful that there are lots of kids that are getting, you know, really enriched kind of science environment, and that's wonderful, but I'm really interested in trying to help the ones that don't feel like they are, you know, that there's such a lot in identity. Yeah. They don't feel that they're scientists. Yeah. Or they've always thought that they're not any good at science, or, you know, whatever these awful kind of preconceptions are that people come along with. And I totally understand them, because I think on a certain level, I felt like that for a while, but I want to help them understand what a kind of creative, broad, amazing subject it is. And I'm really interested in the way people think and helping people to understand things. So those light bulb moments that you kind of see happening. So, and you get so many of those in science if you're lucky. And that's what drives me, I think.
Brilliant. That's so, so lovely to hear. And your passion, I'm just imagining you in the classroom now. And not that obviously I would know exactly what you would look like, but I'm certainly building up a picture of that infectious enthusiasm.
I hope so, on a good day. there are days when you struggle to, but yeah, you just hope that you can convey a little bit of that as you teach, certainly.
And since you've been a teacher, you know, how have you worked to kind of learn more about the research evidence behind teaching or science teaching? How has that been useful for you?
Again, that was kind of an unexpected thing that I didn't go out looking for particularly. I think I was always probably primed to do this, because I come from a science research background. So I did a PhD in chemistry, and then I did a postdoc in marine biogeochemistry. And I love research. I've got to be honest, I love reading. I love finding out about things. I like looking at the background to things and trying to dig below the surface. But it was actually, I've got three children, so I've had three maternity leaves. And so there's a couple of things that happened. That the first thing is that I was on my third maternity leave, and that there's that kind of moment where you feel a bit kind of cut off from stuff, and you want to kind of still know what's going on. And that's when I joined Twitter, basically, and I started to kind of see some of the stuff that was happening. So around 2013, that people were beginning to talk about the beginnings of Research Ed, mm-hmm. but actually that wasn't my lead into it. It was there's a chemistry professor at UEA, Professor Simon Lancaster, mm-hmm. and he used to tweet a lot about chemical education research, and I was so I came in at it from a chemistry education yeah. angle, and they did a lot of kind of flipped learning at UEA mm-hmm. in the chemistry department, and I was really interested in finding out more about that, because it felt like a really good approach for some of the A-level stuff I was doing. Yeah. So that was my lead in. And then it was a time when things really began to open up. And at the beginning, I could never attend any of this stuff. I was kind of watching Research Eds happen online, yeah. but had young children, couldn't attend. And then I think what I was conscious of was that if you're not careful, because I think teachers are a natural perfectionist in some ways, you know, there's that I remember my sister saying when I was training, that actually sometimes a lesson is good enough and that is okay. And there's that, I was that teacher that was always trying to produce the perfect PowerPoint mm-hmm. and the perfect lesson. And I think because we're always searching to do that, there's a temptation to try everything and see a new idea and see someone's doing that and try that. And actually after a while, I wanted to kind of step back from that and work out why something felt like the right thing to do. Yeah. You know, why was it? I'd always had a hunch in my NQT year. I remember I was always quizzing students at the beginning of lessons. You know, this was like, I mean, gosh, it just shows, you know, nothing's new, is it? It's just, for me, so this is 2006, and I would start every lesson going over what we'd done yeah. before. And that, because that's how I'd always learn. And so the interesting for me isn't that I did that, it was finding out why that might be a good thing to do and how that sits with everything else. And not just trying everything because it looked shiny, but trying things because there was a really good, strong reason for doing yeah. it. And then thinking about it from there. I mean, there's that thing about everything working somewhere, and, you know, you have to then look at whether it's right for you in your context, but digging below and finding out why something was a good approach was important
yeah,
for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you've just described, I think will resonate with a lot of teachers, you know, that sort of try this culture, the sort of shiny intervention. I'm sure if we all cast our mind back to that period of education, I think we will all, you know, feel a bit cringy or guilty or
yeah.
you know, thinking that there are these silver bullets, and if you just search long enough online, you'll get them. And I think we all know, whether through experience or just wisdom, that, you know, it's actually taking that time and to think about the why and actually embedding things more critically in our practice to really work out whether, as you say, it works for your particular subject or your particular subject.
And that, yeah, because I think the other thing is that, so first of all, right, I think professional judgment is really important, and I don't want to say that isn't, like, first and foremost, you know your pupils, you know your school, you know your teaching, you know your subject. So professional judgment is incredibly important, but there are some things that feel right, and with hindsight they're not necessarily the right thing to do, or they're not worth the opportunity or the time cost. So I was that teacher that would write half a page of comments on kids' work, mm-hmm. you know, thinking it was the right thing to do. And, you know, to the point where I've said this before, but I remember I used to do a lot of kind of feedback stuff from kids, you know, asking them to, at the end of term, kind of tell me what they thought about various things. And I remember one kid just saying, like, you just write so much on our books, nobody writes as much as you or something. And I took that as a real badge of honor. Yeah. And actually, with hindsight, I think, why? I mean, I don't think they, I think, you know, sometimes they read it, did it move them on as much as it would have done if I'd spent the hours that I spent writing comments, you know, doing something for the next lesson. And so I think that's another important aspect of it, that professional judgment and professionalism, and we are professionals, that is the first step. But actually, you sometimes need that kind of critical, almost removed eye, don't you? Because it's so easy to be emotionally invested in something, and sometimes that step back is really useful, I think.
Absolutely. And I think particularly on the issue of, you know, you touch upon feedback there, but I think we can tell ourselves a narrative about why we're giving feedback and we're doing it the right way and we're putting in all this effort. And it's, and I think this is where the evidence is particularly helpful, because I think if we look at it, it forces us to think about the impact of what we're doing. That's you know, time kind of cost angle versus, you know, the extent to which students are actually learning from this. And, you know, I think we need to be honest with ourselves as teachers about whether, you know, we are spending our time in the most effective way. And actually on that, and I know you'll be familiar with it, in the last couple of years, the EEF produced a guidance report, you know, setting out recommendations for most effective approaches for teaching science. And actually one of them was around, you know, feedback. As a science teacher, to what extent did you find that report, you know, helpful for your practice amongst all the other evidence that, you know, you're aware of and have used as a science teacher?
Well, the first thing is that, you know, I was there, so I was on the panel that helped kind of choose what they looked at. So I guess, you know, I have to hold my hands up that, it, you know, I knew what was going to be in there. And I think actually it's not controversial, actually, to say that I don't think any of it came out as particularly surprising, you know, but what it did do was it underlined which aspects of good science teaching that good science teachers were doing anyway were, like you say, were worth kind of spending that time and that effort on. And it doesn't take away, it wasn't a prescription or a directive, or, you know, it wasn't supposed to, but these were the things that when you were focusing on planning and teaching, these were the things that were worth, you know, that there was enough kind of evidence and enough behind it that they were worth spending time and effort and energy on. So I think that's how I see it. I see it as a kind of almost as a lens to look through as you do your planning and your teaching. And sometimes, you know, working with teachers, I think what quite often happens is, understandably, people were already thinking about some aspects. Yep. And then there were some others that they hadn't thought about in so much detail. And sometimes it gave you the confidence or the, you know, the reason to kind of focus a bit more on something. So, for example, something that I kind of did a little bit was, because I'm that kind of person, is I you know, I modelled my thinking quite often in my teaching, and especially at A level when you're kind of going through long processes. So that's something that I kind of probably did ad hoc when it felt like it at the time, or whereas now it tends to be something that I know is really valuable to do, and I will plan how I'm going to do it, and I will plan when I'm going to do it. So it's not that I have started doing something I didn't do before, it's that it becomes a more conscious decision to do it. So yeah, I think for me that's where it helped. Whereas other people, it opened up a few things they hadn't maybe considered before, and others it confirmed what they thought. You know, so it different people at different stages.
Absolutely. So in relation to research evidence, I know that you're part of the hashtag COGS Size Side community online, which is a bit of a mouthful. And for science teachers or just any listeners to the podcast, could you explain, you know, what this group is or what this hashtag is and why teachers might find it valuable to be part of it or aware of it at least?
Yeah, I think it's worth telling you how it started, actually. It started off with four of us and then five of us kind of chatting on Twitter. It was around the time when Jana Weinstein and the learning scientists were doing such an amazing job at really kind of getting stuff out there. I mean, as an exercise in kind of communication, that was amazing. That kind of took hold, and so it was just, you know, we were people that were interested in it, and we started chatting about it, and so, you know, it was me and Adam Boxer and Ruth Ashby and Deep and Pritesh, and I think we were the kind of the kind of four or five people that were just chatting about how to use this stuff.
Yeah.
And then we decided to meet. And so we decided to meet for a day in Norwich and we kind of just opened it up to see if anyone wanted to come along and join us and just chat about this stuff. So we've heard about this kind of learning science and cognitive science or this broad area, and we want to think about how this specifically kind of is related to science teaching. We were all science teachers.
Yeah.
And so we wanted to meet up and talk about it. And we thought, you know, maybe there'd be kind of, you know, us four or five and a couple of other people. And honestly, we started turning people away. We kind of, and in the end, we did end up with about 20 people, I think. And so it was very much, let's just get together and think about how this might relate to science teaching. Mm-hmm. But Deep was the one that was very, very clear that if we were going to do this, and in the discussions we had beforehand, he said, we've got to make sure there's some kind of legacy from it. We've got to make sure it isn't just everybody meeting up for the day and having a nice time, and then we just go away and do our thing. And actually, with my EF hat on now, with my research school hat on, he was exactly right. You know, we know that good professional development, good CPD, it means that it's not just that lovely one-off thing where everyone thinks, oh, isn't that nice? And it has to have some impact. So Deep is the one that really, I think, made this thing happen. And I don't think he particularly meant this to happen, but he said, you know, we've got to find a way of making sure that we share and we continue what we're doing. And so it just turned into an online forum and a hashtag, you know, and now we have something like 1,400 people in the group. It's just a Google group, and people email and they share ideas. And what I love most about it is that it is genuinely very, very supportive and open. And there are people in the group that, you know, you would consider as experts in this. You know, I won't mention names, but it's wonderful that we've got some people that sign up that this is kind of their whole life and they research in this area. And then there's a lot of people that are experts because they're teachers and they're using this thing every day. And so people just chat and ask questions and people answer, and we've, since the meeting in Norwich, we've met up a couple of times since then. We were supposed to be meeting again this year, but obviously we couldn't do it in the end, but for me it's just a really lovely supportive community of science teachers that share ideas, and you know, mostly based around cognitive science, but not only.
Sure.
You know,
and I think in your description there, I think what really kind of stands out to me of what makes that community really powerful is perhaps two things. So one is really looking at cognitive science evidence and translating it to a subject. And I think that's because there's kind of a job there to do, isn't there, about using the sort of recommendations from research evidence in a particular subject context, in the type of classroom or the age of learners that you're working with. And I think that's so powerful to have not just a cog-sci group, it's the cog-sci science applying that to science. And then the other thing that seems particularly powerful is within that group, within that Google group, you have obviously your experts who are the teachers, but then you've got the experts that are more on the academic side. So you really have that sort of interface and that sort of to and fro between the research and the teaching community, which sounds a particularly powerful relationship to have.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, we're really clear that, you know, there's like no hierarchy or any kind of even implied, you know, and that it is a space for open questions as well. And nobody's saying, I think the other thing that understandably there's been a backlash at times about, you know, whether we're saying that this is you know, that cog-sci is this kind of the one way of doing everything. For me as a teacher, it just explained, it started to explain some of the things that I was doing and I was noticing, and it just gave me a kind of, I think so much with research, it's like this common language, isn't it? So suddenly, you know, I begin, when I was worrying about how hard my students were thinking, for example, when Rob Coe's, that's my laptop going off, you know, when Rob Coe's What Makes Great Teaching report came out, and although it, for me, all those little light bulbs started to come on then, it's explaining, it's being able to predict and to explain and to understand the why things potentially were happening, why a particular approach was a good thing. And that for me is where the cog-sci comes into it. It's not something I had a huge background in, but being able to learn a bit more about how people learn and why people think in certain ways and why it's important to link things back to prior knowledge, for example. It doesn't mean that this isn't talked about elsewhere, and it doesn't mean that teachers aren't doing stuff around this anyway, but for me it was a really helpful kind of area for discussion to kind of learn more about it.
Absolutely. And I think actually, certainly for me, this is almost resonating with something you said right at the beginning, where you were talking about your students and you know, this issue around their identity, like do they see themselves as a science student, for example, and there can be issues around whether students, you know, really sort of buy into that or see themselves in that way. And I think quite a lot of what you've said really talks to the idea of teachers' identity, you know.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, I just think it's just really powerful in what you say, that such an important part of your kind of job and your thinking is really about looking at the why. And I suppose communities like cog-sci-sci or you know, access to research evidence, I suppose, enables us to think in that way.
Yeah, that's, I hadn't thought of it from that angle, but that's a really interesting idea. And I think, and maybe that also begins to explain some of the more negative kind of aspects of that sometimes, which is people potentially feeling alienated or feeling, you know, that the tribalness, is there a word, that sometimes happens. And yeah, maybe that identity is all a part of it. Mm. That's interesting. Mm.
So, Nikki, it's looking like we may be making a normal return to school in September, but I say normal in inverted commas. What do you think are the best bets for science teachers when they get back into the classroom with their students?
Oh, that's a really interesting question, because obviously it's going to be at the forefront of everyone's minds. I think, do you know what my biggest fear is? My biggest fear is that people are going to return in September and think that they have to stick students in an exam hall or something over and over again to try and work out where they are or do something. I think so. September, however it plays out, is going to feel different, and we're going to have enough to think about. And the thing that we know that comes through over and over again, you know, in the rapid evidence review about remote learning, in, you know, the work that Mark Rowland's done on pupil premium and so on, that the thing that makes a difference to teaching, whether it's science or English or whatever it is really good quality teaching. And so I hope that people will have enough confidence and support and space to just remember, you know, what that means, and amongst the mayhem, you know, because there'll be a part of us that, I mean, in normal life, I am that teacher that never catches up with anything. I always want to teach something so thoroughly and repeat it and review it and come back to it that I'm always kind of chasing my tail. And I just think that that feeling that that decision that we always have to make as teachers of how much you kind of carry on with stuff, because you know that you want to make sure you cover everything and you give everybody a broad education and so on, and how much you return to things and teach them more deeply, that is going to be there in spades, isn't it? If we've got this feeling that we've kind of missed teaching time or we've missed curriculum time and we want to catch up. So I just think, I hope that people will be able to remember, you know, that so for example, on some level, diagnostic assessment is going to be really important, right? Because kids are going to have picked up, students are going to have picked up various misconceptions. We're not there in the classroom with them. We need to make sure we understand what they are and be able to respond to those. But that doesn't mean exams, that means teaching, that means kind of asking questions within the course of a lesson, being responsive within that lesson, kind of making it all very low stakes and in continuous and embedded within the lesson, and really kind of, you know, as we do as teachers, finding out what our individual classes and our individual students need as we would normally. And I think that's going to be really hard in the backdrop of everything else going on, but if we think of anything, I think that's what we have to come back to. And then all the other stuff, because there will be other things, like, you know, for example, in science, how is practical work going to work for a start? I mean, even little things, I mean, it's not a little thing, but even very unusual things, like the fact that science departments were brilliant and gave away like safety glasses to hospitals when they needed them and things like that. Absolutely. So there's a whole different kind of starting point in terms of practicalities. And so I think, you know, what do I think we're going to take from it? I think it's going to be, this is where research comes in, where we kind of pare it down a bit and think about what really matters. There's a really interesting blog I was reading today by Ben Newmark the gap and what we do about it. And he says, you know, if it means that we kind of pare everything down and concentrate on the things that really matter, and, you know, maybe that's one positive that can come out of this awful situation. So, but, you know, that needs confidence and it needs support and it probably needs a bit of kind of time and headspace to think about beforehand. But I think, you know, good quality teaching, as we know from research, is the thing that's going to make the biggest difference amongst all of this what can I call it, chaos, upset, mayhem, unprecedented times anyway. So
absolutely. And I think, Nikki, that is just such fantastic advice, and I think, you know, you hit on it there, that much as we know that is the thing that makes the difference, and it does kind of come through in the research and also in our own experience, you know, we see that is the most important thing. It actually requires confidence to stick to that right now, because there is the temptation to throw the kitchen sink at things when actually, you know, paring back and focusing on that, you know, excellent practice in the classroom, you know, as you say, is our best.
I think so. Yeah, I hope so.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
You've been an absolutely fantastic guest on this podcast. And I just know listeners will have really enjoyed this episode. So can I thank you again for giving your time and, importantly, your wisdom to us all.
Oh, thank you, Caroline. Thanks for asking me.
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Best Bets. To follow up on the ideas and references mentioned by Dr. Nikki Kaiser in this episode, head over to our website, researchschool.org.uk/Sandringham. If you enjoyed this episode, please do rate us and write a short review if you have time. Ratings and reviews allow others to see the podcast when they're browsing. Do also subscribe to the Best Bets podcast, and you'll be able to get the next episode automatically through your app.